Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today, Tim. I really love it when we have the chance to bring something historic to our listeners. A historic crime. We get to go back in time. But Tim, I want to stay right here in the present, and I want to know presently how you're doing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks a lot for asking. Yeah, I'm excited to introduce this conversation, and this is with a fellow that we met at CrimeCon 2023. His name is Eddie Ancera. He's got an interesting project that he's working on, and it has local connections to Boston, Massachusetts. And as you know, Lance, we're both from this area. And so this subject was of immediate interest to us. And it's about his grandfather.
His grandfather, who was a turncoat of sorts. He worked for the IRS, and then he was dismissed from the IRS, forced out, because he had too much information on certain political administrations. And he then went right over to the Boston Mafia and started working for them, representing them in their financial dealings. So he went from trying to put those guys away to working for them as a way to get back at the IRS. Eddie's story is taken directly from papers that his mother had given him and said, here, do what you want with this. And his outlet is to create a podcast that is called Agent Zero. And so far, the story is super interesting.
And you can't really listen to the podcast Agent Zero yet, because it hasn't quite been completely produced at this point, but Eddie is working on it and he's looking for partners too. So if you've got any ideas, you can find Eddie on Instagram at Hustle247. That's his personal page, and you can get in touch with him there.
And Tim, where can folks find this episode plus all the other episodes of Crawl Space plus all the other episodes of the other podcasts that we produce without any commercials, those pesky commercials that pop up every so often? Where can one go to be free of this burden?
Well, our good listeners can now subscribe to Crawl Space Premium on Apple Podcasts right there in the app. But if you're not an Apple user, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm and sign up for Crawl Space Premium there, and you'll get ad-free episodes, early releases, and our bonus show that everybody loves.
All right, we're going to break for one of those aforementioned commercials, and we'll be right back with Eddie and Sarah and the story of Agent Zero.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hairs from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone. And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
Welcome to the podcast, Eddie and Sarah. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing fantastic. And it's so great to finally be connecting with you because we met you at CrimeCon. You were on our list and we finally got to you and your project's amazing. But introduce yourself. Tell people who they're listening to right now.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate you guys making the time. Great to connect, especially with some local guys. So my name is Eddie and Sarah. My day-to-day is I'm an internet guy. I'm a technology guy. I have a couple of software internet companies, and I also consult in the x-ray world, sort of an expert on x-ray detectors. But I started diving down this hole of this podcast, and I'll get into it with you guys in a few minutes. It's a great story about my grandfather. I went down this rabbit hole. There's no end in sight. So it's just a great story. And I just want to get this story out there so people can hear it.
Yeah, I think that was what was important to us when we were talking at CrimeCon and figuring out what angle your project comes from. And the fact that this is something that's in your family and not too far removed, it being your grandfather, is really important because I think we've all had that moment where, like as a kid or something, you find old photo albums and then you start looking at these pictures and you start seeing people that you don't recognize, or you see documents and you start like wondering about them. So there's like a nostalgia there. I feel like that's important when we tell these stories.
Yeah, and family legacy as well. And, you know, there's some American history in there as well. And it's funny that you mentioned, you know, you'll find documents in a house. And literally what happened here was my mother had a box of documents and she said, well, I'm going to give these to you. I had not known about my grandfather's career. This was probably about 10 years ago. There was hundreds of documents and we can get into it. But I started diving into them and I said, whoa, this guy, he was somebody pretty important. There are two chapters to his career. One when he was working at the IRS and then one post IRS. But in the middle there, something happened, which is what the story revolves around. I had hundreds of documents on the kitchen table. My wife was like, oh, you got to put these away. Trying to put a timeline together. And like I said, it's this rabbit hole.
Who was your grandfather? What was he like? And what was your relationship with him?
So my grandfather, his name was Fred G. Pastore. And he passed away in 1988 when I was 8 years old. I just knew him as my grandfather. I knew that he was a guy that when he walked in the room at a family party or when I went into his office, people paid attention to him. And he sort of commanded that attention. I didn't know why I was so young. I just knew that he was a guy that I looked up to. He was the head of the IRS Criminal Investigations Unit in the Northeast, but he was stationed in Boston. Started in the 1940s as a regular IRS special agent, sort of bottom of the totem pole. Worked his way up to becoming the man in charge there. This was in the 40s to late 50s. And during that time was when the mafia was really into gambling. His job was to go after people that didn't pay their taxes. Anyone who gambled didn't pay their taxes. So he was going after the Boston underworld, really, were his main targets. He was in a specialized group also called the Racket Squad, where they went after members of the Patriarca crime family, which if you know the Northeast and sort of that history, Raymond Patriarca and the Angiulos, who were in charge of the Boston area, were really some of his main targets, and I found them in his paperwork. That was the first half of his career, being at the IRS, going after these guys. He knew everything, the ins and outs of the laws of the IRS and how to take these guys to court and make sure you use the IRS as a weapon. Back then, that was what got Al Capone, the IRS Criminal Investigation Unit. They couldn't get him for gambling, prostitution, you know, murder, all these things, but they got him for his taxes. The IRS was very important back then to go after these underworld figures. What happened was my grandfather was investigating this one man named Bernard Goldfein. He was a businessman based out of Worcester, Massachusetts. He owned textile manufacturing, so like clothing manufacturing. And he had contracts with the U.S. government for all the military, Army, Navy, everyone else. So he was a very wealthy man and he paid a lot of people off. And my grandfather was investigating him for not paying his taxes and he uncovered some bribery in the Eisenhower administration, who was in power at that time. Eisenhower's chief of staff, Sherman Adams, received what they called, the big thing was a vicuna coat. It's really like an expensive mink or fur coat, but that stuck in the newspapers back then, the vicuna. This vicuna coat was what captivated the media. Sherman Adams had to retire because of what my grandfather exposed, and this corruption went all the way up to the White House. Like I said, Eisenhower's right-hand man, and some people said he was the one really running the show at the White House at the time. It was Eisenhower's second term. He was kind of halfway out the door. Sherman Adams was making the call. So my grandfather didn't make that many friends in the government at that time. So the Kennedys were coming into power. Bernard Goldfein had also donated some money to the Kennedy family, and they wanted my grandfather off their trail. So, hey, get this guy out of here. Bobby Kennedy, who was the attorney general at the time, he had told the IRS, listen, send Fred somewhere else, relocate him. So they gave my grandfather the option to go to Syracuse, New York, and get him out of Boston. This is where the real story is, that my grandfather rebuked that and he held his own press conference in downtown Boston. And he said, they're firing me for political reasons. I'm doing my job to the best of my ability. And I'm going to open up my own tax fraud defense firm right across the street from the IRS. I'm resigning as of today. He had a chip on his shoulder for the rest of his career. So the second half of his career was him representing the same kind of people that he was going after when he was at the IRS. Make sure that they paid their fair share of taxes, but not too much. There was a fine line there, but nothing illegal they'd have to pay their taxes within the legal minimum of the law. And that's really where, like I said, the second half of his career came in. He was their go-to guy. The Angiulos were around for so long because my grandfather was advising on the back end. Here's how you set up your business. Here's how, you know, you structure things. You know, it's a wild story. And I knew nothing about this till I started going into these documents. And for the podcast, you know, we interviewed 12 different people. We've got, you know, about 15 to 20 hours of audio.
Your grandfather, as an IRS agent, was investigating some of the crime families in the Northeast, including the Angiulos. And then when he was let go by the IRS, he started working for Angiulo. And
just to get it clear, he was forced out of the IRS, so that wasn't his choice. He was, well, not forced, but politically pressured to go to Syracuse, New York, where there was no action at the time, and you know, he didn't want that, so he felt like he was forced out. No, so the Angiulos would hire him, pretty much every underworld figure. So when I was 5 years old and I didn't know who he was, I met Steve Fleming in his office. Until later, I found out who he was. Pretty much everyone except Whitey Bulger, because Whitey Bulger didn't care about taxes at all. So he just didn't care. So he wasn't. But Howie Winter, you mentioned previous before this call, the Winter Hill. He was a client. He passed away a few years ago. But all the big names you hear, Cadillac Frank Salemi, and all these nostalgic Boston mafia were his clients because he knew the law. Nobody knew it better than him.
How did he advertise to them?
He didn't. When he was at the IRS, he was on the front of the paper all the time. So everybody knew who he was. He was a racket-busting IRS guy. They called him T-Man at the time, so they stood for Treasury Men. He was always on the front of the newspaper. And inside this box of documents that I got from my mother, there's all these newspapers with him on the cover. So I've got the originals of those, and it's pretty cool. But he didn't have to advertise. As soon as he announced that he was going to go to the other side, so to say, overnight, everybody was lined up to have him advise them.
It sounds like this is something that is a old-timey hero for the people, like the Elliot Ness, like going to bring down the bad guy. Hey, if we can't get him for murder, we'll get him for tax evasion. I know it doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but these come with significant sentences. So if we can't get him for this, we'll get him for this. That hero turned anti-hero. So now he's the anti-hero, and he does it at this press conference where he makes this flip. I can't imagine that there wasn't some element of trust gaining that he needed to do with folks like the Angiulos and the Salemis. How did he manage to, I know you said it was overnight, but I can't imagine that they were like, oh, sure, he's not working undercover. This has to be something where they're just setting us up. How did he get past that?
One of his close friends was a man, he's still around today, he's in his late 90s, and so grateful for him being interviewed, but his name is Frank Demento, and he used to be a prestigious law firm, Demento and Sullivan in Boston. He was the district attorney in Boston when my grandfather was at the IRS. So they would go hand in hand because the IRS didn't have jurisdiction to take these cases to court. They would build the cases, hand them off to the district attorney. The district attorney would charge the mafia guys or whoever it was. They were really tight. Well, Frank Demento, actually, before my grandfather, he opened up his own law firm. He left the district attorney and he opened up his own law firm. And he started representing those kind of people, the underground people, mafia type people. So my grandfather and him were tight. So there was some level of trust built from Frank referring people to my grandfather. I think one of his initial clients was a man we interviewed. He passed away about a year ago. His name was Henry Vara, and he owned a lot of the nightclubs and all over Boston, even Studio 54 in New York. His mother got close with my grandfather, so he didn't trust my grandfather at first. My grandfather, Fred, ended up gaining trust by being introduced to the guy's mother, and his mother sort of vetted my grandfather. I don't know how, if it was intuition or what, but that was just one story that I have on record that his mother said to him, you know what, you can trust it, I believe him. But Frank Demento was a real driving force behind that, that bypassed the normal pathway that you would need to take, you know, to trust someone like my grandfather when you switch sides.
I just want to be clear, are you saying Demento?
Yes, Demento, yep.
Would you ever trust somebody with a last name of Demento? It's like a sci-fi, like mad scientist character.
Yeah. I know. He's still around. Like I said, he's in his late 90s, still practices law, still goes to court, but he's in his 90s, mid-90s, and you can look him up. And he represented names like Raymond Patriarca and the Angiulos, and got some great stories in the podcast from him. Great storyteller.
So how would that work then? How did the mechanics work if your grandfather and Demento had the same client?
Demento was the attorney, and my grandfather was the tax fraud specialist. A lot of the cases that my grandfather had, all of them, I should say, when the clients had big issues, nobody with small tax issues came to him. It was always big problems. So they owed a lot of money, or they were being audited, or things like that. My grandfather would have to dive in, get all the documents. And if there was a case where they couldn't settle with the IRS immediately and they had to take it to court, That's where Frank would step in. My grandfather would represent them on the tax side with their paperwork, but he didn't have any jurisdiction in the court. And that's where Frank would take it from there.
I like the idea of your process being that you came across all of these documents. You're thinking as you get deeper and deeper in that this is an amazing story to tell. And regardless of whether or not it has to do with your family, it's an amazing story to tell. Obviously, have to talk to your family about it. When was that moment where you were like, this can't just be contained here? This has to be put into some form that can go out to the public. And what was the reasoning for that?
Like I said, it was about 10 years ago when I started going through these documents. And even his IRS badge, I have his badge. He still had it. Just out of my own curiosity, I wanted to put the timeline together. But then I had a son about 4 years ago. And I said, really would like this to be a family legacy thing. And they need to know about this. Otherwise, this is going to die. It's just going to be this box of documents. Nobody's going to know about it. And this is pretty important piece of Americana. And he should know that it's his grandfather. And I had another son about a year ago, Eddie and Andrew. It was at that point when I said, you know, I really need to make something out of this for my kids' sake and for my family's sake, that this story can't just die. And you can't Google it. You can't find it anywhere online. So it's up to me. It's either me or it's gone. And also, we brought some of his artifacts to the Mob Museum in Las Vegas. They're going to be exhibited over there. So some of these documents and things like that, I brought over there.
Well, that's pretty neat. Now, is it complicated for your family to wonder what kind of people your grandfather was helping to keep out of prison?
Even myself, I had to take this from an objective standpoint that I tried not to be as biased as I could because, you know, was my grandfather a good guy? Was the government the good guys? You know, that's what this story is. You know, who's really the good guys here? Who's the bad guys? Everyone that I asked and everyone that I interviewed mafia members. We interviewed guys like Frank Demento. We interviewed clients. We interviewed targets. We interviewed people at the IRS that had heard about my grandfather, current agents. None of them could come up with anything that he did that was sort of crossed that line. But like you said, at the end of the day, he's helping these guys succeed on the mafia side and keeping their businesses going. So there is some, you know, not disappointment, but I would say that it's not easy to talk about. He did help these guys succeed for a while, but I accept it for what it is. That's part of the story. And maybe he thought he was doing the right thing. He got pushed out of the government. I know that he had a chip on his shoulder. His motivation was, what can I do every day? What can I do today to beat the IRS? And that's been noted in the podcast.
Can you explain just a little bit more why he was pushed out? You said it in the beginning and you mentioned Robert Kennedy and Syracuse and there wasn't a whole lot going on there. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. When my grandfather was at the IRS, like I said, he was on the cover of the newspaper all the time for being in charge of these raids and even nationwide. He'd be setting up nationwide raids. IRS guys coming down in helicopters. They all had guns and badges and, you know, in Los Angeles and Boston. I mean, he had so much good publicity that he was doing his job so well. And then he just happened to assign this politically sensitive case for this man, Bernard Goldfein, as he dug into his banking records and his numbers, his accounting. Him and his team realized that, holy crap, this guy's been bribing the highest officials. This was at the end of the Eisenhower administration. So it was a huge deal for his chief of staff to resign. Eisenhower didn't want him to resign, but there was just so much public pressure that he took these bribes that he had to resign. Bobby Kennedy really was, he had something out for my grandfather. He just wanted him gone. He just did not want him sniffing around anything that could have been there from maybe their father, who was a bootlegger previously, or his brother, JFK, coming into power. I mean, I have telegrams of my grandfather sending letters to the White House to Bobby Kennedy saying, we've got to talk. I'll come down there on my own dime. He was just too close for comfort, and he was really good at what he did. He would get on you. I mean, if you were his target, he would get on you. He didn't care who you were. You're a Kennedy, you're an Eisenhower. You know, they say follow the money. Wherever that money trail went, he went. And went a little bit too far in the political realm that they had to try to quiet him. And like I said, that vicuna coat was the real thing that stuck in the media. But also he bribed Sherman Adams with hotel rooms, vacations, all these things my grandfather uncovered.
I mean, the IRS is definitely not a sympathetic figure, whether your grandfather's working for them or against them. He sounds honorable, and I feel like there's no doubt in my mind that he's probably felt like he was doing the right thing no matter which side he was on. Where did my question go? Sorry. I was setting up for a question.
Perhaps it had to do with IRS agents dropping out of helicopters with guns. And I was trying to think, like, would I find that more or less nerve-wracking when they drop out of a helicopter and say, freeze, IRS?
No, I was thinking it's more terrifying.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Like, freeze, police. I'd be like, okay, freeze, IRS is so specific.
I can even give you an example of one of his other cases that we dive into. It was with the Raytheon manufacturing company. So they called my grandfather when he was at the IRS and they said, listen, we've got a gambling problem. Nobody's on the production floor. We're supposed to be building missiles and nobody's working. My grandfather had to infiltrate with some of his guys. He didn't physically do it, but his team did. They had to apply through the normal job process and get hired because they could have got tipped off by anyone, by the hiring people, whoever. So anyways, they got hired as janitors and they were there for a couple months and they ended up finding out that the gambling people were taking the daily numbers. So back then the daily numbers were a big thing, like today's lottery. You put in the numbers you want. If you hit, you make money. But these were all done by people who collected the betting slips on the spot and collected the money from the bettor. So they ended up finding out that all the gambling was going on in the bathroom stalls. All the lines for the bathroom were long all day long and nobody's on the manufacturing floor. And this was highlighted in the magazine back then. That's how they busted them.
So how do they do that? Do they then round up the employees and do the employees realize that the two janitors that were hired 2 months ago were the informants?
They did. They actually raided 5 buildings at Raytheon at once simultaneously in order to stop them all at the same time. I don't know what the outcome was, how the employees felt about it, or if they knew it was the janitors.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
So my question is, this switch in your grandfather at this point that he is forced out from the IRS, what have you learned about that? Did he talk to his family about that?
So he has 2 daughters. My mother is one of them, and my aunt, my mother Charmin, and my aunt Pam. And we interviewed them about that. Unfortunately, my grandmother's not around either, so I couldn't get that information from her. But there was some talks at their house about if he should take that position in Syracuse, and he decided not to. But I guess it was a rough time, and he was very depressed because of how the IRS had treated him after doing that work. So he was really in his head trying to figure out, did I do the right thing? It was just a tough time for the family. And I did hear, this is hearsay because I don't have anyone on record, but I did hear that there was a hit on my grandfather from the Kennedys, actually. And like I said, this is hearsay.
Whoa, this is hearsay. Tell us more about that.
Exclusive.
Yeah, this is hearsay. I mean, when my mother and my aunt were growing up, they always had to have the shades drawn. There were always people watching him when he was at the IRS, and that was for the mafia reasons. Going after those guys as targets, so there was always cars outside their house watching, things like that. Supposedly, when he was having this issue with the Kennedys, with Bobby Kennedy specifically, there were a couple of people that said, hearsay, they can't prove it, that they wanted my grandfather out bad enough that they would take it to the whatever they had to do to get him out of their way.
Did you then go back to the documents and analyze them a little bit deeper to see if there was anything further that your grandfather might have found out about the Kennedy administration or the family?
I did look. I didn't see anything about the Kennedys in particular, but Bernard Goldfein was just, he was just wrapped up in a bunch of different people. There was a real web there of who he was paying off and who he was friends with, people in high positions. But I didn't see anything particular about the Kennedys.
And time frame wise, you said this was when the Kennedys were coming into power. Is this right at the beginning of the administration?
Yeah, this was right before they came into power. The Goldfein case started in 1958 and Kennedy came in 1961, I believe. And my grandfather resigned in December of 1961. But yeah, it was at the tail end of the Eisenhower administration when Sherman Adams, his chief of staff, had to resign because of the bribery that he uncovered and then dovetail into the Kennedy administration. The key was JFK's brother, Bobby, was the top cop in the nation. He was the attorney general.
But why would he want your grandfather to stop the illegal gambling, I guess, and the take that the mafia was getting from the public?
Well, the big thing was that Goldfein had contributed to the Kennedys and the Democratic Party. I think it was they might have been afraid of what my grandfather could uncover. He was from Massachusetts. They were from Massachusetts. So there's a lot that he could try to figure out locally.
I think that really says a lot for the way things have changed since the late 50s, early 60s, mid 60s. What I'm saying is media-wise, like we are so desensitized to things like that now. We see like 5 headlines a day. That's something that back then would have been, this could take down my not only administration, but my family legacy. So we need to get this guy out of here. Just from that perspective, just from that lens, you said that this is sort of a slice of Americana, more on the like criminal side of things. But I think if you look at it like that, it's really revealing to just see like how desensitized, again, we've become in the overall sense of time. Not a whole lot of time has passed.
But the Kennedys are heroes.
But the Kennedys will always remain heroes.
I was at Thanksgiving dinner and there was a picture of John Kennedy hanging up on the wall.
Yeah, you know, and we reached out to Robert Kennedy Jr. for an interview, but at the time he was doing the vaccine sort of stuff, I guess, and he wasn't available. But back to your
he was weightlifting on Muscle Beach.
But back to your point, Lance, about how things have changed so much. My grandfather's whole career revolved around going after gamblers who were sport betting and betting the daily number. All that stuff is legal now. That you're talking about your lottery, DraftKings, sports betting. So all this stuff he was going after them for back then. The government decided, oh, maybe, you know, there's a lot of money going on here. We can tax this and make a lot more money off it that way. So much has changed in a short period of time.
And all of our roads have gotten so much better from all those tax dollars.
I can't agree with that.
If you don't agree with me, I'm sending you to Syracuse.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Did this at all put any strain on the relationship with your mother or any members of your family that they didn't want this story out there, or they all saw the importance in it?
It put strain when I interviewed them, and they didn't want to give up names of his clients or things like that. So I had to dig for those. You know, my father actually ended up taking over the business when my grandfather died. He worked for my grandfather. My father took it over. So I heard stories from him. And my father passed away in 2015. And the business is actually still going. It's in Lexington, Massachusetts. And it's ran by my cousin, whose name is Fred Pastore. It's funny, but it's a very small business. Only a couple of clients now. It's just self-sustaining, but it's still around. It was stressful. It was stressful trying to get some names out of people. Nobody want, especially that generation. They don't want to talk. None of them want to talk. I mention names and I don't know any of them, D'Angelo's, Patriarchas. You know, I'm just interested in this, that time period. And I think Tim said before we started talking that he was watching Black Mass recently. I'm a big fan of this genre, you know, even before this. I don't know any of those people. It's part of the story and nothing negative about any of them. You know, my grandfather was close with Jerry Angiulo.
We'll make sure to mention what you said before we started rolling about Jerry Angiulo in the intro. We'll put it in the intro.
Probably right in the intro, right?
Cold open.
Cold open, yeah.
No, just kidding. So that is weird to me, though, right? Just taking a step back. Now, you said the incoming president and his brother had more trouble with your grandfather while he was an IRS agent than the mafia did on a personal level, as far as that goes. Like, you didn't hear of your grandfather's life being threatened while he was working for the IRS, coming from, like, the mafia angle, right?
Like I said, you know, my mother and my aunt, they were always being watched. That wasn't by the IRS.
So there was like people outside in cars, like watching the house?
Yes. My grandmother always used to say there was people following them when they went shopping in Boston, down to Filene's and this and that. There was definitely threats there from the mafia side when he was working at the IRS, for sure.
So no side was safe for him.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah.
You said when you knew him, people paid attention when he walked into a room. I'm wondering, aside from what you've read about, what was he like before or in his early career in the IRS? Was that something he always wanted to do? Because you said that he was so effective in his job and he excelled at it and he was always making headlines. Was that always like the goal for him, was to do that level of work within the IRS? Or did he just kind of fall into that?
Came from an immigrant family. So his parents, my great-grandparents, came from Italy, and they sacrificed a lot when they came here to try to make a living for the family, the American dream and all that stuff. And they realized that my grandfather had a talent for numbers. I think they had 4 or 5 kids. Out of all the kids, they said, we're going to bet on Fred. So they all pooled their money together, the daughters, the sons, they all worked and supported Fred to go to college. And he excelled. So he went to Northeastern, BU, I believe, and then he did postgrad at MIT. So he was really good with numbers. And then he ended up getting his CPA, Certified Public Accountant certification, or whatever that is. He was really good at numbers and he decided to go into the IRS. And I think he would have done well being an analyst or anything else that had to do with detailed numbers and forensic accounting. He was at the IRS and that just happened to be where he was, and he excelled there. In the story, that's part of the overlap between him and Jerry Angiulo, is that they were both good at numbers. Jerry was sort of a genius on the gambling side. He had this ingenious way how to get the daily numbers, but also how to get referrals from people by paying them extra for getting more people to bring their numbers to him and things like that. And Fred, on the other side, on the IRS side first, was a genius with numbers, where he could follow the money, figure out where things went. So there's some overlap there in that genius with numbers.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
When he started this firm and said that he was going to move it directly across the street from the IRS, I'm wondering how much of a ripple effect that had in that professional circle. Did he have people come aboard as team members, and were they inspired by him? Did they go do similar practices, branch out on their own?
Well, some of them at the IRS, they did, I don't know if it was immediately after, but maybe a few years or so, they didn't work at the IRS anymore for whatever reason. So when my grandfather did have a big case, he would sort of contract a lot of them in to sort of work for him and figure out, like I said, the forensic accounting. So a lot of his employees were contracted in when needed. But he had sort of a core staff of maybe four or five people that were not IRS related. The business was on Court Street in Boston, originally on Milk Street, but on Court Street in Boston. I remember going there a few times when I was young. It was great.
Tell us what your plan is with the podcast.
So the podcast, we've got about 10 to 20 hours of audio. You know, amazing people, Howie Carr, mafia members, like I mentioned. Even one of my grandfather's ex-clients was, he ended up being the owner of the Palazzo and the Venetian in Las Vegas and partners with Sheldon Adelson, you know, billionaire. You know, he's from, I think, from Brookline, still living out here. He's an older gentleman, close to his 90s as well. We interviewed all these experts and interesting people, family members. So we've got the audio. It's not produced yet. So we have a pilot. That's about all we have right now. All of the audio is cut up into clips and things like that. But what we're really looking for is to find some potential partners that maybe have an expertise in writing or maybe getting this in the right format for us to get this out the right way. But we don't want to half-ass it. We want to make sure that it gets done the right way. I really do. I'm really pushing for that. So we really need some experts. We need a little bit of help in that end, whether it's production partners, financing partners, writing partners. If anyone out there is interested, I would love to hear from you. The feedback that I've gotten from this podcast so far has been, this needs to be a visual. So the audio story, I love the audio story, but everyone says this needs to be a visual. I can see it being a movie or a TV series. So my end goal, real end goal, grand slam, would be to get this made into a TV series or a movie. What I did was, I'll tell you a little marketing thing that I did. So at my internet tech stuff, we love to do creative marketing. So I said, okay, this is an audio podcast, but let's get a group of people to listen to this pilot and see what the feedback is. So I said, how can we do that in a controlled way? Everyone listens to it at the same time where no one's distracted by their phone or gets, you know, they're in their office or their kids are coming in. So we said, let's play this in a movie theater. So we rented out a movie theater. We've got about 50 to 60 people, contributors, people interested in the genre, family, and we played the pilot. I put some pictures on the screen so that they weren't sitting in a dark theater just listening to audio. That would have been strange. And we got standing ovation at the end of it, clapping. Everyone loved it. I, you know, got a feedback session at the end. Everyone loved it. But again, the feedback was, this needs to be a visual. When's the next episode coming out? You know, it's got a lot of appeal. It's compelling, compelling story. We'd like to see if anybody out there is willing to help us.
As far as like all of the branches that you can go out on genre-wise, there's a lot of crossover and there's a lot of appeal there because true crime has a history crossover. If there's a history crossover, there's probably some family like nostalgia thing that's happening there as well. So I think that there's a lot of richness in the storytelling. And your podcast has the title Agent Zero. And at first I thought it was in reference to your grandfather, that he was Agent Zero. And now I realize that you are Agent Zero. Is that right? Because you are the factor. Oh, come on. You are the factor that's getting all of this together.
I'm just a small piece. I'm just putting it together.
Oh, no. See, that has to be the big reveal. Like, you have to be the guy behind the guy.
That's true. That's true. When I got these documents and I started making this sort of timeline on my kitchen table, my mother had come to me. She showed me her phone and she said, this guy reached out to me on Facebook Messenger and he said he's an ex-IRS agent. He's interested in some work from my father. Should I talk to him? Is this a scam? What is it? So I looked at it and I reached out to the guy. I emailed him because he left his email address. He replied. He said, yeah, Eddie, I reached out to your mom 4 years ago and she never replied. She doesn't know anything about technology. And so his name is Jim Donahue, and he's one of the guys we interviewed for this. He's sort of an IRS historian. He introduced me to Howie Carr and all these people. So Jim really helped in that respect, and that's just a funny part of the story.
If this were to become a movie, or when this will be a TV show or movie, like, what is the biggest moment of this story, the most visual conflict of this story?
The press conference, for sure. That's where this, moments where the two worlds collide. what are you going to do after the IRS? And I believe that's sort of the press conference is the main sort of collision that happens. And I think that could be entertaining. But there's plenty of other spinoffs to this story. I mean, during the process of the research for this podcast, we ended up finding out that my grandfather's brother was a confidential informant of his. No one knew that. You know, there's records I have of him with his binoculars at Revere Beach looking out the car window and a cop tapping on the window saying, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, I'm just looking at the girls in their bikinis," because, and this is literally what it says in the letter that the cop wrote. He said, "My wife is frigid." He said, "So I'm looking at these girls because my wife is frigid." And the cop is writing in the letter, "You know, we're giving this guy back to you." I forget what, Medford Police Station, actually. And he said, "We're going to give this guy back to you," as you can imagine what his next steps are here. And then another letter, the guy, that same cop sends 2 days later saying, "Oh, we didn't realize he was a confidential informant. He was actually doing a stakeout at one of the gambling locations right on Revere Beach Parkway." So there's so many twists and turns and pieces to this story that really can be visualized.
That's pretty remarkable. So he was a confidential informant and his cover was that he was basically a pervert.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the IRS was pressuring my grandfather to give up his informant. I have all the letters, and he wouldn't do it. I mean, it went all the way up to the regional supervisor saying that you need to give up your informant. And no one knew why he wouldn't give him up, but he was his brother.
Well, that's pretty good. That's definitely a really interesting element to the story.
Yeah, that's just one of the many, many subplots or sub sort of scenes that you can imagine are in this.
And as far as people reaching out to you and offering services or quoting prices for services, because we know that there's individuals in this industry who will hear a story like this and you saying, "I need somebody to help put together the narrative. Like, all of the pieces are here. I just need somebody to put together the narrative and figure out a way to tell the story in a podcast form, in a way where people can consume it." Where can they find the contact information if they feel like they can contribute in a productive manner here?
Yeah, I'd love to hear anyone out. Feel free to reach out. It's sort of informal, but, and I'm going to promote my internet company because that's what we do, is we're sort of like, you see these, all these companies now where they aggregate all your social media into one link. Well, we were the first ones to do that. We were the pioneers of that. So I'll give you my link to that company. It's called itsmyurls.com/Eddie, E-D-D-Y. And you'll see my Instagram, Twitter, email, all that stuff is on there. You can always email me directly, Eddie and Sarah, EddieInSerra @gmail.com. Follow the Agent Zero podcast on Instagram, which is just Agent Zero Pod. And you can message me there as well.